Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Republican Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker wins again. In his victory speech, he sent this message to the nation.
Tonight, we tell Wisconsin, we tell our country, and we tell people all across the globe that voters really do want leaders who stand up and make the tough decisions.
In Beverly Hills, before lesbian and gay backers, President Obama said he's proud of the changes his administration has brought and took a jab at the GOP.
We've got some stuff done these last 3.5 years. With relatively modest cooperation from the other side.
And starstruck, a young bystander watches Venus dance across the face of the sun.
You can just see a faint orange dot, and then there's a little black dot on it. You could only just half see it.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ben Smith of BuzzFeed, David Shepardson of the Detroit News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Has Wisconsin breached the wall for unions? Is there a growing antipathy for organized labor? Do you worry that campaign cash has gone crazy? And if people agree on equal pay for women, where is it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I want to say hello to everyone and just say that David Shepardson, who is joining us, he's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. David's been delayed. So hello, Ben, and hello, Jack.
Hi, hello, Jackie. For having me.
Hello, Jackie, and hello, Ben.
And we'll hope that David gets here soon. So let's begin with Wisconsin. Not a good week for President Obama. Ben Smith of BuzzFeed, the National Democrats, they mostly didn't want this fight, and it looks like we might know why. What's next?
Well, Democrats basically stayed out of Wisconsin. You know, Obama campaigned nearby, but never quite made it into the state. Bill Clinton went there long enough to kind of mess things up a bit, but the Democrats did not put real resources into this because I think they saw it coming and they didn't think they could win. The local party was divided. It had become seen as kind of a labor fight rather than a broader fight. But it was a pretty bad day for the White House. It was a terrible day for organized labor and particularly for public sector unions, who now just have a huge bullseye on their back for executives who want to at least cut what public workers are paid, if not actually break the unions.
Yeah, Jack, do you agree with that? And Jack, by the way, every time I come here, Jack Beatty, do you agree that the labor has a bullseye on its back now?
Yes, and look at how things have changed. Just a decade ago, the regnant cliche was everybody who went into those buildings on 9/11 belonged to a public sector union. People were saying, look at the dedication. Look at, you know, hundreds died, firemen, emergency workers, policemen, trying to save other people, every one of them a member of a union, and they were lionized. And now, a decade later, this attack, also in California, two referenda curbing public sector pensions. What happened in between? Well, what happened, of course, is that what's happened to the economy. It's become leaner and meaner for everybody, and there is out there a strong element of envy. I don't get much of a pension. Why should they? You know, that feeling is out there. It's exploitable. It played some role in this Wisconsin deal. I'm sure it played or will play a role elsewhere. And it's just it's a blow not just against organized labor, but really against the American middle class, which was a creation. let's not mince words, of organized labor in the post-war era.
Yeah, but there certainly is a presence of tons and tons of middle-class voters. We heard from lots of them in Wisconsin.
I mean, I think I would just add, I think there was what you saw, though, was a division between public and private sector unions. You're seeing it in New York, actually. In the New York Times today, there's a great story where you saw private sector unions, building trades, people like that, supporting Andrew Cuomo as he went after the public sector unions. It's these public sector unions who, you know, if you've covered a state legislature, who get these legislators who they elect, their own bosses, who they then work for, who have been voting them these kind of pension sweeteners and conditions that are extremely generous in giving them in backdoor ways that I think a lot of voters were, in fact, angry about and legitimately.
Jack, I just want to say, your point about how they were lionized after 9/11, I do remember that. You know, I remember using my own tape recorder to get the sounds of plumbers, for example, coming to fix things in that great heap. It really is a very different time. By the way, I just want to mention that President Obama is giving a press conference any moment now. He's going to be talking about the nation's economic woes, European debt crisis, and we will try to work that in before the end of the hour. Let's talk too about the presence of the money that existed in Wisconsin. One of the clips that we played earlier in the week came from Madison, where after Tom Barrett had lost, and this supporter of Barrett's was moved to tears and said that the impact of the recall would travel far beyond Wisconsin's borders.
We're not just disappointed. This is the end of democracy. We just got outspent $34 million to $4 million. This was the biggest election in America.
Well, you know, that seems to be one point everyone agrees on, that it's all going to travel far beyond Wisconsin's borders. But what about this money, guys?
Well, you know, if I may, if you look at it, someone did an analysis on a political science blog today. In 2010, the election of 2010, Walker outspent Barrett 2-1. He outspent him 7-1 in this election. And what did the differential result in? An extra point. So money matters. But if all that 6-1 ratio, a 5-1 ratio mattered, was 1 point, it isn't decisive. Sure, a garland of billionaires helped float this. But I think the beyond the money, I mean, the exit polls make clear there was just a tremendous resistance to the idea of using this extraordinary procedure of recall for something, anything short of moral turpitude.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. This money matters most when nobody's paying attention. In the lowest attention races where you can kind of just sneak someone in, where people are going to glance at a TV ad or a mailing and make their choice in a very uninformed way, everybody in Wisconsin was paying a lot of attention to this. There was nobody who missed this. There weren't very many people who didn't know what they thought about it and who the next TV ad was going to convince. I think there, at some point you hit diminishing returns with those television ads.
But we are seeing just such record amounts being raised because of the Citizens United decision and the pension that very, very wealthy people seem to have now for, if you will, collecting politicians like polo ponies. $70 million in May for Mitt Romney breaks what? All of Barack Obama's fundraising for all of last year? What, Jack, what do you think that's doing to our democracy?
Well, nothing good. I mean, this is the world according to democracy, according to John Roberts, Chief Justice, and the Citizens United democracy. I think there's some, you know, for the future, there's some hope. Television is a dying medium. I mean, let's face it. Look at anybody. Look at anybody under 25. Do they ever turn it on except for the occasional sports show? No. And eventually we're going to have our own, you know, our own private little media. And the good of that will be they won't be able to do these ads. Well, but that's a long way off. And meanwhile, a democracy is going to be buffeted by lots and lots of cash.
Okay, let's take some calls here. Bill is calling from Rochester, New York. Bill, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. My question really has to do with the impact of the money in a divided campaign like there was in Wisconsin. If the local Democratic Party was not united, would it have mattered if they had all kinds of money to spend, or would it have just prolonged the agony? Thank you.
All right. What about money in a this wasn't such a close election as it turned out. And we were just discussing whether or not money made a difference. Ben, is there a lesson? What do you think the takeaway lesson is when it comes to the cash that was spent there?
I mean, I think maybe it's less about the impact it had in that election, but just the quantities of cash that are available, particularly to conservatives right now who can convince people like the Koch brothers that they're the true standard bearers of this kind of new aggressive conservatism. there's a sort of this new, very ideological conservative money that has come off the sidelines. And whereas, you know, Karl Rove was used to raising money from these Texas, these rich Texans who wanted the Republicans to win, the new money has a much more ideological agenda. It's much more about reshaping the rules of the game, particularly around labor unions.
Which, let's face it, Chuck, gives money mostly to Democrats.
Yes, and of course, that was the subtext, really, and not just the subtext, it was the essence of the Walker move last year. Recall, the unions were willing to meet him on money. They were willing to meet him on pensions and benefits and so on. That wasn't enough. He wanted to end collective bargaining for them, to curb their rights to organize and to petition for better working conditions. And that was aimed directly at the Democratic Party. That was using the power of state government in a political way, under the screen of we're dealing with a budget emergency. Whereas everyone knows the real motive was essentially dry up the funding for the Democratic Party and cut down on union membership. And look what's happened in Wisconsin. AFSCME, I think, just a couple of years ago had 60,000 members in the state. Now they're down to 25,000. So it's working.
Yeah, and they threw, 1.8 million phone calls, over a million doors knocked on, 50,000 volunteers. So it wasn't like they didn't turn out a massive effort. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and you are listening to On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week's top stories. With me today is Ben Smith from BuzzFeed and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. We were closing out the last time, guys, just talking a little bit about the election in Wisconsin. Let's move nationally. In a campaign speech yesterday in San Antonio, Republican candidate Mitt Romney said that President Obama is making fundamental mistakes when it comes to the nation's economy.
We have a president today who doesn't really understand the fundamentals of what makes an American economy go. It's these individuals, free people, given economic freedom, pursuing their dreams to create the new jobs that allow people to have rising incomes and bright futures. And so what you've seen over the last 3.5 years is a presidency designed to have government play a larger and larger role. And it's become more and more burdensome on enterprise.
So that is Mitt Romney speaking in Texas. President Obama, as we noted, speaking very soon about the economy at the White House. Ben, who do you think is owning the economic argument at this point?
You've basically got Obama to this point making a case for optimism, Romney making it for pessimism. And, you know, the economy right now is favoring Romney. The numbers are favoring Romney. And I think, you know, the challenge for Obama right now is it looks like he needs to find a new way of talking about the economy. It looks like what he's starting to do is say, actually, things are really messed up and it's the Republicans' fault, as opposed to things are getting better, we're on the right track, stick with me, which is a real change and a really hard case to make.
Mm-hmm. Proving the negative into it and turning it into a positive. Jack, do you think that the president is shifting, as Ben was saying, a little bit in terms of his nuance and how he's – I mean, these numbers have really been a drag on his campaign.
Yeah. Oh, unquestionably. And I think it's a – you know, he's got to make a – I mean, he's trying to say, you know, things could be worse and Governor Romney is saying things could be better. It's a very tough case. But when you listen to Mr. – you know, just leave out politics. Just look at logic and economics. When you hear Mr. Romney say that this – that private enterprise has been damped down by this administration. Corporate profits are at an all-time high. The stock market, if you look at it in the Obama years, as other than ups and downs, has basically been going up, 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 up. Corporate America is sitting on, Fort Knox's of cash without spending it. And they're not committing that money to investment, not because of over-regulation. That's just absurd. But because of lack of demand. But mm-hmm. because, you know, ordinary people just don't have enough money to spend. And that was the president's argument, and it should be. Put money in their pockets. I mean, the Republicans now are holding up in the House, are holding up a transportation bill that could put 1 million or 2 million people to work over the next 5 years. It passed the Senate by 74 votes with nearly 20 Republican senators, yet the House has bottled it up. Why? Well, it would help the economy, and that would help the president, and they don't want to do that.
I noted that Sarah Palin said that Wisconsin voters had chosen to embrace austerity, which I'm not sure that it would be interpreted that way in Wisconsin. Let's take a phone call here. Eric is calling from Montpelier, Vermont. Hi, Eric.
Yes, my comment and question is in regard to the conservative, National Conservative parties and their spending in their campaigns. They're outspending phenomenally in Florida, just what happened in Wisconsin. And, you know, as that is a model for campaign, you know, how I don't understand how they can talk about when once elected, they'll be cutting spending and doing the job for less, when in fact currently they're doing the campaign job for quite a bit greater cost.
Okay, thanks for that point, Eric. Can we move to another, with all this money sloshing around, just another thing that came up in Washington this week that I think a lot of our listeners would find important, and that is what went down on the Paycheck Fairness Act, which went down in the Senate. Speaking on the Senate floor on Tuesday, Republican Senator Dean Heller of Nevada explained why he saw what he saw as the key flaws in the Paycheck Fairness Act.
This legislation opens the door to frivolous lawsuits, which already cost our economy billions of dollars every year. In an economy already marked by uncertainty, this legislation would surely mean lost jobs, limitations on benefits, and pay cuts.
And lots of pushback on that. Lily Ledbetter, who earlier this year had success in legislation named for her, on Tuesday on the Rachel Maddow Show, she was really angry at the senators who voted against the Paycheck Fairness Act, and she said that it pushed equal pay for women and men.
It really disturbs me when I hear people that's voted into office in Washington and they will vote against something that would help most American families across this nation.
Is this going to help Mitt Romney with voters? He's been moving up women voters. He's been moving up a bit with women voters. Is this going to even be an issue when it comes to the national campaign? Ben?
I mean, I think this was, you know, this legislation was crafted in part to be an issue in the national campaign. And I does reflect a real difference between the parties in terms of, you know, whether women should have the right to sue about some of these equal pay issues. I think it reflects the kind of the Republicans' confidence that they can win these fights and that people are so focused on sort of the totally core economic issues that they can get away with taking what appear to be unpopular stands on popular legislation like this.
Yeah, and you know, it really, I mean, who can be against it? I mean, well, obviously the Republican senators were.
Yeah,
the New York Times, I think, is right. These are bills to nowhere. These are message bills meant to embarrass the other party. The Democrats did it in the Senate with this. They had no chance of passing in the House. And the House does it all the time. You know, the House just keeps passing things that have no chance of even being acted on in the Senate, and they keep, you know, sending messages to their constituents with them. They're bills to nowhere. Meanwhile, the economy goes to hell while the parties signal each other in Washington.
Yeah. Well, let's turn away from our borders now and talk about Syria a little bit. I was listening on the way in here to a particularly grisly report from Al-Kabir, the site of the massacre near Hama in Syria. Really frustrating world leaders. Yesterday in Istanbul, Turkey, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton condemned Syrian President Bashar al-Assad for the ongoing violence in the country.
The regime-sponsored violence that we witnessed again in Hama yesterday is simply unconscionable. Assad has doubled down on his brutality and duplicity, and Syria will not, cannot be peaceful, stable, or certainly democratic until Assad goes.
Ben, I know that you spent a long time in Washington. You're joining us from New York. But I'd like you to take a look. World leaders, and certainly this administration, has been absolutely stymied for over a year now, tried to double down on getting Assad out of power, sent in Special Envoy Kofi Annan. UN monitors were fired on yesterday at various Syrian checkpoints. It's not working. So what next?
You know, I mean, I think this is one of these situations where it's not clear what next. The Donald Rumsfeld was on TV the other day saying that the two options are, you know, to dither or to send in the Marines, basically. I think that's kind of the consensus seems to be that that's true and nobody is going to do the latter. I think some of the more aggressive Republican stances are to hope that regional powers, particularly Turkey, gets involved very aggressively, that the Turks start arming the Syrian opposition and start sort of allying themselves with, and that we would sort of covertly or sort of financially support regional powers getting involved. But it's just a situation. It's one of these situations. It's so easy to say never again, and then very hard in these situations to make a call to spend blood and treasure on it.
Yeah. Let's listen to a clip of Kofi Annan speaking at the UN Security Council yesterday, saying things will only get worse for Syria if something's not done to stop the violence.
If things do not change, the future is likely to be one of brutal repression, massacres, sectarian violence, and even all-out civil war.
Let's take a call here. Jerry is calling from Cookeville, Tennessee. Welcome to On Point, Jerry.
Hi, Jackie. I don't think we should send any troops whatsoever in Syria. However, I think we could use the unmanned predators. I think we could do a lot of damage with those. We could take out a lot of their their soldiers, their tanks. With our satellite photos and stuff we have, we know where these people are at. So if we want to do something, we should do it like that. But we should not send any troops there. Russia, I mean, they're going to be their ally no matter what this guy does. Russia is not going to vote to do anything to actually do that would bring down the that regime. So we can forget about Russia as helping us.
All right.
So if we're going to do anything, I think we ought to hit them with the predators.
Okay. Thank you, Jerry. You know, Jack, hit them with the predators. I was thinking, well, for all the controversy around that, and heaven knows it's been intense. Yes, this week, drones did take down Yahya Alibi, and that was a success for the drone program.
Yeah, and you know,
number two in Al-Qaeda.
Yes, and instinctively one says yay to what Jerry's saying, but I just think as a practical matter, first of all, getting such a thing through the UN, you know, getting any sort of approval for violence against the regime, that seems almost impossible. And then would the United States want to work out an ad hoc coalition, go that route again? Well, who would join it, and what would be their reason? It looks like the Assad has calculated that he can kill his way out of this, that in the absence of coercion from outside, and every day governments say, we're not getting involved, we have no troops, we can't. He knows he can keep going and keep killing. And I think that there's even a method to this murder. I mean, that these massacres have been, of Alawite militia killing Sunnis in villages. Well, I think Assad hopes for is that the Sunnis are going to respond and there'll be massacres in Alawite villages. And already, of course, the regime opponents are acknowledging that there have been armed groups that have been killing and kidnapping Alawite villagers and so on. So when that massacre happens, or if should something like that happen in an Alawite village, that'll, you know, pull every Alawite and minority in the country behind the regime in an almost, you know, fighting off genocide. And on the other hand, for the international community, it'll morally so muddy the waters that there'll be no appetite to, even the diminished appetite to intervene will will abate.
Yeah, and I can just imagine, you know, what the neighbors would be saying in Iraq, in Turkey, if drones were to start crashing in Syria. But it has been, and such a problem with Pakistan. Speaking on Thursday in Afghanistan, let's listen to Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta expressing his frustration with the Pakistani government over the amount of terrorist activity in the nation.
It is an increasing concern that this safe haven exists and that there are those like the Haqqanis who are making use of that to attack our forces. We are reaching the limits of our patience here.
Reaching the limits of our patience. And while he was visiting Afghanistan on the same trip, guys, you may remember that President Karzai, while Leon Panetta was in town, condemned these kinds of attacks, which also had bad effects in Afghanistan this week, killing civilians.
Yeah, I mean, it is such a mess there. And, you know, Panetta, before he went to Kabul, he was in New Delhi. And he actually seemed to be aligning the United States with India and saying, you know, we both have these problems with Pakistan. India has more than problems. It's had several wars with Pakistan. And he was aligning the United States and saying, we share your frustration at this government. You know, we're in a this whole situation where we've been on the one hand giving them aid, and on the other hand they've been sheltering our enemies. It is finally, I think, going to stop.
Yeah, let's take another call here. Chris is calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, of course. Welcome to On Point, Chris.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. I actually wanted to make a quick comment about Syria and intervention there. While I'm not a pacifist by any means, I really don't see any call for military intervention by the United States in Syria, because I don't see any specific national or security or strategic interests of ours in Syria. While I appreciate the humanitarian needs, war is a risky thing, and I don't think that we should be engaging in any sort of military conflict there unless we have a specific definable interest there.
Okay. Thank you for that comment, Chris. Ben, have you been paying any attention to the uproar over leaks about secret wars and drones and cyber attacks that the administration has been launching at the Senate Intelligence Committee this week?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's been going on for a while. This administration has actually been very aggressive about prosecuting low-level leakers. There have been, I think, like twice as many prosecutions of people who leaked to newspapers than you know, the combined total of American history before the Obama administration. At the same time, they had this pattern of they really like to do these stories in which there's a big foreign policy win, and then a month later in the New York Times, there's this detailed story with interviews with 36 senior aides, that all of which make the point that Obama kind of strode manfully into the room and made the central key decision, mm-hmm. and it was really all him, and it was all the president, kind of personalized, whether it's the, you know, killing of Osama bin Laden or the decisions around Afghanistan. And so in which they leak all sorts of secret information to the Times reporter in order to tell that story and to make Obama look good. And I think the Senate Intelligence Committee finally kind of had enough of that.
Hmm. Do you think the timing was political? The White House says that's ridiculous.
I mean, the decisions to leak information about to make Obama look good, I mean, I don't know. I think that's politics, right?
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. On Wednesday, author Ray Bradbury died at the age of 91 in Los Angeles. The author of more than 50 books, his work spanned science fiction, horror, and mystery. Here he is in an interview wishing for more time.
I'd love to live to be 101 so I can finish 30 or 40 more books and 300 or 400 more short stories and an opera and several plays. There isn't enough time, and I want more.
Yesterday, former football players who sustained concussions and brain injuries filed a lawsuit accusing the NFL of covering up the health risks. Here's former Chicago Bears quarterback Jim McMahon.
We knew there was going to be a chance for injury, but we didn't know about the head trauma. And they did. And that's the whole reason for this lawsuit.
And Queen Elizabeth celebrated her 60 years on the throne in an elaborate and festive four-day Diamond Jubilee celebration. And on Tuesday, onlookers exploded into cheers on the last day of the Jubilee. You can join the conversation. Is football ready to tackle head injuries? And beyond those fantastic hats and fireworks, what did you make of the Queen's Jubilee as you peered through the London fog? And with me today is Ben Smith from BuzzFeed and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Yesterday, Ray LaHood, Secretary of Transportation, announced that really there has been an epidemic going on in terms of distraction, texting while driving. Let's listen to what he had to say.
Just about every American has a BlackBerry or a cell phone. And the reason that I've used the word epidemic is we think we can use them anytime, any place, anywhere, including behind the wheel of a car. And that is where it is not safe.
James is calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, James.
Hi, Jackie. As a 19-year-old, I'm part of the demographic, I think, that when everyone talks about the texting epidemic they're referring to. Personally, I do my best to not. I think it's stupid to text while driving, but on occasion I have. I think one of the underlying causes of the texting epidemic is our generation, my generation, feels the need to be connected to all their peers, our friends, all the time. I think that's one of the things that everyone has right. We need to be connected to everyone, and that includes when we're driving. And people my age, I know, don't drive for very long distances at once, more than 10 or 15 minutes across town to a friend's house or whatever, in my experience. And our need to be connected is so overriding of everything, we can't even take that 10 to 15 minute break from that connection to keep ourselves and other people safe. And, I mean, I think it's ridiculous, personally.
All right. Thank you, James. I feel like a show of hands here, Ben and Jack. Is there anybody who hasn't texted while driving or done something with that cell phone that they shouldn't be doing while driving? I'm not talking about, I confess I've read articles while driving. Stopped in traffic.
But. Yeah, I had sort of at some point made myself a rule that I was allowed to do it at red lights, mm-hmm. which my wife informed me was not actually the rule.
I think what James said was so interesting and insightful, that really commenting as someone caught up in it and saying, why do we have to be in instant contact with one another? Is that, can't we even wait 10 minutes? I thought that was so interesting. And these penalties that are coming down, I think someone has been given a jail sentence in Massachusetts, and there's been a driver's license suspended for 30 years. I mean, you've got to have exemplary and severe punishments out there so that people are just going to say, I may never be able to drive again if I do this. Of course, that was the Massachusetts case was in an incident where someone was killed, but that's just a matter of chance. The probability of someone being injured rises exponentially when you're not looking at the road.
Right. Well, David Shepherdson has gotten here, and he was actually at the Ray LaHood press conference. David Shepherdson, Washington Bureau Chief for the Detroit News. We're really glad you made it in.
Thanks, Jackie. Hi.
I'm hoping that texting while driving had nothing to do with, I guess you did have some sort of mishap in traffic.
I did. I don't think so. But, you're absolutely right, especially among younger drivers who don't have a lot of experience. You see so many incidences of texting while driving leading to very serious accidents. And part of it is just sort of human nature. When that phone is sitting in the front seat and people see it buzz, it's hard not to lean over and pick it up. And we're just also attuned to that. But just looking off the road for a split second can really lead to deadly consequences when you consider you're driving around these 4,000-pound machines. And remember, traffic crashes are the number one cause of death for people ages 5 to 34, cost society $200 billion a year, still accounts for more than 30,000 deaths annually in the U.S. A million people die worldwide. So it's a very serious problem, despite a lot of progress that's been made.
Yeah. That's nothing to be humorous about. Miles is calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Welcome to On Point, Miles.
Thank you.
And your point, Miles?
Okay, I have a daughter. She's 33 now, and she'd had a car wreck when she was 30, which put her in a coma to the point where they wanted to organ donations. Well, she came out of that. She was texting when she had the car wreck. Then she had another wreck where they had to pull her car out of a tree when she was last year. She was 33. So she was texting. Now, since there was no drugs or no alcohol involved, there wasn't much that the judge was going to do to her because she had to get full coverage and insurance and everything. And what I did, I hired a lawyer. I'm her dad. And got the judge convinced that she was driving under the influence. Right now, she's sitting in jail doing a 60-day sentence and for driving under the influence. They changed the law years ago from driving DWI, driving while intoxicated, to driving under the influence.
The influence,
my lawyer decided, was the cell phone.
Wow.
And the judge agreed.
Thank you, Miles.
That 60 days in jail.
60 days in jail. Thank you, Miles. That's fascinating. A DWT for texting. That's so intriguing, Jack Beatty.
Yes, and what an act of civic, well, I suppose you could say civic principle, but how hard a thing for a parent to do something like that. Ooh, God.
Absolutely. What a story from Miles. David Shepherdson, can I ask another sort of auto country, if you will, a different type of issue entirely, but does apply to autos in Michigan. Republican candidate Mitt Romney said this week that if he were president, he'd sell the government shares in General Motors. And we were wondering how that's playing in Michigan.
It's a pretty interesting idea. I think what the governor, former governor, is trying to highlight is the fact that the auto bailout, although it saved, by many estimates, a million jobs, was not inexpensive, and that the $85 billion the government set aside for the bailout, their current estimate is the taxpayers could lose somewhere around $22 billion because General Motors stock has not fared well recently. The government's loss, if it sold those shares in GM, could be about $16 billion. That's because the government swapped most of its loans for shares in the company. And, you know, I think the issue about re-litigating the bailout does not necessarily work well for the governor. He wants to focus on jobs and what he can do to improve the economy, whereas the Obama campaign really wants to focus on you know, what would have happened if the governor's prescription had been, which was to not give the companies any money before they went into bankruptcy, something that could potentially have led to GM and Chrysler not continuing to exist today.
Let's take another call. Lou is calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome to On Point, Lou.
Yeah, Jackie, look, I just real quick here with this NFL lawsuit. This is an outrage. Simply put, I don't even know why this is even being spun as a legal item. I mean, the whole nature of the game, football. Football is a contact sport. To listen to Ray Lewis of the Baltimore Ravens in the pregame when he's trying to psych their whole idea. And these are defensive linebackers. These are the ones. These are the strongest voices on the part of this lawsuit. They're the ones that emanate the strongest, hardest hits. Their objective in life is to kill quarterbacks. Their objective in football life is to kill running backs. And now they want to get oodles of money in a lawsuit for this? This is an outrage, Jeremy.
Right.
Simply put, this is an outrage.
Okay, Luke. Thank you for calling, and you certainly expressed your point. Ben Smith, when we talk about football, I mean, certainly this year, Lou's calling it an outrage, but we've also seen football players admitting that they accepted money to hurt people. Have you been following this? Do you think that this lawsuit by former players is an outrage, as Lou was saying?
I mean, I think the it seems like we're at the beginning of this sort of predictable course that goes through the courts that you saw with things like cigarettes, that you know, that's going to really reshape the way that sport is played in America and who plays it. I mean, at some point, I imagine it's going to be hard for high schools, in a lot of states at least, to sustain football programs in the face of threats of litigation.
Interesting. Jack? Is that Dave?
I was just going to jump in. Think about 100 years ago when Teddy Roosevelt basically saved football because it was so violent that you were seeing deaths, not just in college, but in you know, throughout the country from football. And I think Ben's right that there will almost certainly have to be changes made to make the game less violent because of all the research that's being done into brain damage from football players.
Yeah, it would certainly make you think twice about encouraging a youngster to get involved in a contact sport like football. I mean, the evidence is there. Anyway, Janine is calling from Swampscott, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Janine.
Thank you for having my call. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. What's your point, Janine?
Oh, yes. Well, we were talking about the Queen. There was a comment about this week and what people thought about the pageantry and what was happening in London. And I found myself thirsting for more. I watched a documentary drama on Netflix last night called The Queen, just so that I could see more about what really happened in her life and in her history. I just think she's a remarkable woman. I think it was a great testament to the, you know, English traditions and history, and is a lesson for all of us here in the U.S. with such a short window of history to reflect back upon.
All right. Okay, thank you.
You know, yeah. I quite agree there are lessons there, and I watched the pageant on the Thames, and it was moving, and, you know, there were even boats there from Dunkirk that were, you know, people were just applauding their great history and the pageant. There were 1,000 vessels in that pageant, in that float, and some of them were kayaks. In fact, most of them were real small. Well, at the last Diamond Jubilee, in 1897 for Queen Victoria, there was a float or a sort of naval procession held to honor her. And 500 warships were there.
Wow.
500 warships. And that was only, you know, the British had another 300 or 400 overseas. So, yes, I think it is a moment to reflect. Look at that. Britain had a superfluity of battleships in 100 years ago, and now it is a third-rate military power. And, you know,
rub it in, Jack. Rub it in.
I don't want to make any parallels.
It does really bring out this does, you know, it's funny, the kind of anti-royalist thing in America has obviously been in decline for the last couple hundred years. But I did notice that for certain people, I saw some muttering about despots on Twitter. And, you know, I think that for certain people, this brought out that old anti-monarchical sense.
Yeah, that's because they don't actually watch TV, which Jack was saying at the beginning. And so if they had watched it, they could have seen through the fog all the ships that Jack was talking about. Janine said she is, what, thirsting for more, would love to hear more. And let's hear a little bit more. Here's Queen Elizabeth addressing the nation in a pre-recorded 2-minute speech. She expressed gratitude to everyone who helped celebrate her 60 years on the throne.
The events that I have attended to mark my Diamond Jubilee have been a humbling experience. It has touched me deeply to see so many thousands of families, neighbors, and friends celebrating together in such a happy atmosphere.
You know, you can't not want to hear her say the words Diamond Jubilee. It's just really quite delicious. I have to make a pivot here because we've just, and pivot to President Obama, because we've just had news that in the press conference, speaking of Europe, he is saying that European leaders should inject capital into weak banks and take further steps to avert recession. He's also asking Congress to act on remaining parts of the jobs bill amid weakness in the world economy. And he said that Greece needs to recognize that hardships will likely be worse if it leaves the eurozone. Sounds like the president, Ben, is trying to turn the corner on a lot of bad news for him this week and talk about capital and jobs in a different way.
Well, I mean, I think he's turning to try to push Europe to act in a way that, you know, he hopes will reduce what he's referred to as headwinds, you know, from an economic problem that he has very little control over, but that is has a massive impact on the American economy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you already see Europe's in a recession, and a lot of American companies are already pulling back substantially investments there. And, you know, if things get worse, the U.S. could be pushed into a recession. And as Ben said, there's not a lot the U.S. can do except jawbone the Europeans into doing something similar to what we did in 2008 when the U.S. injected hundreds of billions of dollars into its banks and is still in the process of unwinding those stakes today.
Very quickly, Jack, do you think the Fed is going to act?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, it's so hard to penetrate Chairman Bernanke's statements to come to any lucid result. It seemed on the one hand, on the other hand. I do note that the Beige Book, which is their sort of, you know, preliminary estimate of how the economy is doing in different parts of the country, that was positive this week. They had a lot of good news in there. Now, I don't know. Does that mean they'll act? It won't act? Or does it mean they don't think they have to act? We don't know.
Well, it's been a lively conversation. We covered a lot of ground. David Shepardson, we give you big points, big on points for getting here. We're so
Thanks,
happy
Jackie.
That you joined us. Ben Smith, same to you. Great
Thank
to have you.
You
from New York. Jack, always a pleasure, of course, Mr. Beatty.
And pleasure is mine.
Look forward to being with you again. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook, On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden. I'm in for Tom Ashbrook today, and this is On Point.